DMR, D-Star, All-Star, see what else is there. I'm sure I forgot one. But the usual digital modes. So please join us. Just go to my QRZ page and they'll tell you how to do it. Get to the net. So thank you, Roy, very much. AB6MB.
Very welcome, Jeff, and welcome to join us every Sunday that you can. So I appreciate your participation on the technical net. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. We do this every Sunday night at 8 p.m. until hopefully about 11. And for the amusement, enjoyment, and edification of us all. Does anyone have any other questions or comments for tonight? If so, hit that push-to-talk button and say your piece.
KP2VHD with a short comment.
Yes, certainly, Jim.
I thought it was interesting how, I had been thinking about this before tonight, but the antenna on Mom's house conversation really brings it to the fore that Andy was talking about working hard to try to bring, to put a phrase on it, make the technical net technical again. And it is, and he should, and that's all good stuff. But it's just technical conversation brings along with it some baggage, whether it be politics of home life or politics in a bigger sense or social things. I don't think AI is a popular topic of technical conversation today, but that crosses all the boundaries. So I think it's important to recognize that is part of technology is where it fits into the rest of the world. And I like the fact that happens here. That's probably why I enjoy it the most. I'm not as technical as some, but I try to be well-rounded. And I'll be back. KV2VHD.
Well, thank you, Jim. We try our best. You know, science is great. I'm a big lover of science. I can chat about other things. But there are not strictly science-related situations that are important because in addition to science, we happen to be human beings. The social aspect of this hobby is an important to break it. If you live with someone who has control of the residence and you have no means to convince them to let you to do things, then you're out of luck. So that's as important as antenna design and how a software-defined radio works and all the other things that we talk about. So I agree with you, and that's why at least my technical net is designed the way it is, with more open-ended. You can't please everyone all the time, so you'll find some people who think that we've gone way too far off topic, but then other people who like when it goes off topic. So you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself, as the song went.
Roger, I enjoy it immensely. Back to that.
Okay, very good. Things seem a little quiet, so why don't we do something a little weird, a little different? Paul, you mentioned that you were very interested in the news story that they were working on ways to separate oxygen in space. You want to chat a little bit with me on that?
Okay, yeah, I read this last week, WS2N. You know, astronauts are going to be making long trips to Mars someday. And who knows where, you know, maybe the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, you know. But they need to bring oxygen with them all the time, you know, or they need to bring water, and they use electrolysis to separate it. And apparently this one article was saying that they're able to use magnetism to somehow pull oxygen molecules to separate them in a fluid. And apparently the fluid is, you know, hot, a little viscous. It's a little thick, and they're able to, you know, take these oxygen molecules that are in there and somehow pull them, I guess, to one side But it looks like they're doing it on an experimental basis. You know, I don't know how you could size something like this up, but they believe you could have, you know, magnets and electricity and instead of all these, this other complicated systems that they use, there's other systems that they could use as well, besides just electrolysis. But this magnetism working on atoms is something that they're thinking about. My problem is, of course, how in God's name can a magnet pull an oxygen molecule one way or another, or any kind of atoms for that matter, you know, unless it's, you know, metallic or ionized. That's kind of beyond me. But that's the article I came across, where I know you've read something about it as well. Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS.
Okay, AC2GS. Yeah, for the audience's sake, and you mentioned it more than a few times on the SpaceNet report, the way, generally speaking, that space vehicles recycle things is they'll take use the soiled water, and they'll cycle it through a device that gets out most of the water and leaves most of the other nasty stuff behind. It then takes the water and puts it through an electrolysis device. Electrolysis device is very simple fundamentally. It supplies a given voltage across an anode and cathode of a solution of mostly water, a little bit of electrolyte to improve the conduction. At the cathode, if you have an electrolysis device here on Earth, and I used one in high school, the cathode will release little hydrogen gas bubbles that rise to the top. The anode will release oxygen molecule gas bubbles that raise to the top. And everything is peachy keen because we have buoyancy. In space, there is no buoyancy. Because buoyancy depends on gravity, and if you have no gravity, you have no buoyancy. So here on Earth, you just have a column of gas that you can turn a valve and release it. In space, you're left with something vaguely reminiscent of seltzer, in that there are these little bubbles, but because there's no buoyancy, they just sit there in the middle of the solution, and there's no easy way to kind of scoop them up and use them for the next step. By the way, the next step is interesting as well. We talked about it, the Saboteur device, which takes hydrogen gas, mixes it with the carbon dioxide that you breathe out, and generates more water, and the waste product is methane, and that's vented into space. But getting back to the problem, let me drop for a sec. Okay. Presently, what people in space do these days is they put that seltzer stuff in and I'm very loose with that term. I just want you to get the kind of image of little bubbles kind of all over the place, and they haven't really risen to the top. They put it in centrifuge. Buoyancy doesn't work because gravity doesn't exist, but centripetal force does exist if you have a centrifuge. So you put it in this massive centrifuge, you spin it down, you get the oxygen, and you have oxygen, and you follow up with the hydrogen, etc. The problem is that centrifuges are big, heavy, and very mechanical, and not reliable, and expensive, and when you scale them up, they become massive headaches. So all things being equal, the people involved would like a simpler solution. What is a simpler solution? Well, many years ago, I sat you all down and discussed magnetism with you. There are different types of magnetism. Most people think of magnetism, they're really thinking of something called ferromagnetism, which is seen in things like iron and nickel, and I'm blocking on the third element. But anyway, those are things that, in the presence of an external magnetic field, can produce their own magnetic field, and when you turn off the external magnetic field, they can maintain it. There are other types of magnetism. Let me drop with that. There are other types of magnetism, though. There's something called paramagnetism. Now, paramagnetism is somewhat very similar to ferromagnetism. Something that is paramagnetic if it's surrounded by an external magnetic field, it can develop its own magnetic field. But it only lasts for as long as the external magnetic field does. If you collapse the external magnetic field in a paramagnetic material, its magnetic field disappears. So it can never be a permanent magnet. It can be magnetized temporarily inside another magnet's magnetic field. Diamagnetic is kind of the exact opposite. It doesn't produce any magnetic field induced by an external magnetic field. And the two qualities that the paramagnetic and diamagnetic are interesting. Paramagnetic materials are attracted to a magnet. Diamagnetic materials are repelled from a magnet. So the big question is, you have a bunch of water and you have oxygen and hydrogen. Oxygen happens to be paramagnetic, so it will be drawn to the magnetic field. Hydrogen is diamagnetic, so it will be repelled by the magnetic field. So the trick was to apply a strong magnetic field and see if they could get some migration of the bubbles in the two directions, and then they could tap them without needing without having to spin the darn thing. So they put it in an interesting test device, which is basically a free fall device. For about, I think, 10 seconds, the thing just drops. But effectively, within that zone, it's like it's in a zero-G or low-G environment. And they have results suggesting that this is a doable thing. So they'll be working on it in the future to develop permanent magnets as a method of separating hydrogen and oxygen from the electrolysis device.
Very good, Roy. And I was reading they plan on using the neodymium magnets, which, of course, are very strong and permanent, so you don't have to worry about charging a coil to create a magnetic field. Okay. Very well done. I just didn't know that an oxygen atom could be pulled one way or another. I didn't know it was like ionized.
Yeah, actually, there are more than a few YouTubes out there in which people have cryogenic freezers. Our own Wes has a cryogenic freezing device. And if you simply use room air, you will liquefy room air. Room air is approximately 79% nitrogen, 20% oxygen, roughly 1% argon. Now, if you then take a neodymium magnet and drop it into that bucket of liquid air, and then raise it up, you'll find that there's a lot of liquid that kind of sticks to the magnet. That's all oxygen. So you could actually use that with liquid oxygen to separate it. It's not a very efficient way, but it's an amusing demonstration on how oxygen is paramagnetic as opposed to nitrogen.
Very good. Very good, Roy. I had no idea. And it turns out hydrogen is the opposite, so that sounds like it would work. Yeah, that was the problem. They needed to be able to do this, you know, as they're going from planet to planet, you know. I guess it really wouldn't work, or would be unnecessary if they were, let's say, on Mars, you know, within a gravitational field. They needed to do this, you know, when they're commuting.
Yeah, I mean, although Mars, the gravity is less, it certainly is enough to have buoyancy be the cheapest method. Now, electrolysis is not the most efficient, and a lot of time is spent tweaking the additives that people put into the water solution to get the most oxygen and hydrogen per watt. If anyone has nothing better to do someday, just Google hydrolysis column. And I still remember I did that back in high school. I had a little honors project of calculating something called Avogadro's number, which is the number of atoms in a something called a mole. 6 × 10²⁷ atoms or molecules in it. And I used the hydrolysis column, and it was loads of fun. And, of course, for people who are inclined to start fires, you get a steady supply of oxygen. You could have a match that you blew out and put it near the oxygen, and it'll start the fire from the timbers. And you could do fun things with the hydrogen, which is mildly explosive. So chemistry is fun, a little bit dangerous, but fun.
Very good. And on the Perseverance rover on Mars now, they have something called a MOXIE. MOXIE is a small version of what you were talking about earlier, the saboteur type of effect. We're taking the carbon dioxide that's part of the atmosphere of Mars. You know, most of the air on Mars is that. They're taking that and they're separating the two in this chemical gadget called the MOXIE, and they were able to create their own oxygen, pull the oxygen out of that atmosphere, and collect it inside the this container. So of course, you know, you would need, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times that size to actually create a working facility on Mars, but they needed to test it out and see if they could do it, and it did work. They did that a few months after Perseverance had landed on Mars, so that was successful. And another step in the right direction. You know, getting a rocket to Mars is one thing. The infrastructure on Mars is going to be something else. Back to you.
Yeah, I think with present technology, it's going to be insurmountable. I mean, a temporary stay, possibly. A long-term stay, that requires a great deal of work. They're not going to be in any physical condition to do that kind of work when they land after a long zero-gravity trip. So I wish them well, but I don't know how anyone's going to do anything. But a little extra for the Sabatier effect or synthesis or what have you, is the waste product is methane. You could theoretically play around with the methane molecule and turn it into some kind of fuel as well. So, you know, don't waste anything on Mars if you can.
Oh, yeah, I know. And they could take the methane, and once they have the oxygen, and, you know, run that through a fuel cell system as well for electricity, and, you know, you'd have fuel for keeping your habitat warm, or you get enough of it, you can put it into a starship that Elon Musk is building and blast off from Mars. These projects are all doable, but I don't think they're going to happen tomorrow. Anyway, very good, Roy. Thanks for going through all of that. Back to you.
No problem. I kind of love the field of magnetism. Any opportunity to talk about it. So you got to realize, though, that if you're going to do these things with fuel cells and such, you still have to find some source for some more oxygen. So, you know, the laws of physics cannot be disobeyed. They don't give you a summons or have to pay a fee. It just doesn't work. So in order for it to work, you have to apply the oxygen that you just went through all the effort to reproduce so that you could breathe. So theoretically, a lot of things are possible. Is it worth it? Is the risk worth it? We'll see. Anyway, thank you, Paul. Thanks for the opportunity to do this little story with a little twist. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope you learned something. And I hope you come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. But it's now 10:29, and certainly time for Paul, WS2N, and the Space Report.
Thanks, Roy, and we'll see how long we can go here. It seems like my voice is still a little gone, but not bad. I feel fine, though. After playing around for 1 week with COVID, what are you going to do? would. My wife and I, we run around with masks, and we still got the bug. I think it's because other people aren't. You know, you need, you know, it takes two to tango. You know, you walk through the stores, and if nobody else has a mask on, you're only getting 50% of the protection if you have one. But who knows? Anyway, as far as the SpaceNet report, yeah, we missed last week, but we're back this week. And about a little over a week ago, NASA came out with a new plan, on bringing back samples from Mars. We talked about Perseverance, the rover, this one-ton vehicle that's been riding around for a little over a year now. About a year and 7 months. And it's all nuclear powered. You know, it's running on plutonium-239, so you don't need solar panels, and it's able to operate at night, no problem. Recharges its batteries when it's doing a lot of heavy work. It'll take that charge from the batteries. And if it goes as long as Curiosity is built the same way, also nuclear powered, with these RTGs, these are radioisotope thermoelectric generators that are powering these things, you know, we're going to get a lot of use out of both rovers. Perseverance is drilling core. They're taking core samples as they go. I think they have 8 or 9 already done. They plan on eventually, they have the capability of doing around 40, but they plan on sending about 30 samples back to Earth someday in the future. And up until recently, about a week or so ago, they had more of an exotic plan on how to get these things back. They plan on sending two more launches to actually land on the planet. One vehicle was going to land, and it's going to have a solid fueled rocket on board. It's about 10 feet long, and that's going to be the one that's going to be sent into, you know, off the planet of Mars into orbit with the samples on board. But to get those samples, they're going to send a completely different vehicle from Earth, also land on Mars. And it was going to be a fetch, they call it a fetch rover. European Space Agency was going to send this thing driving around to all the different locations that Perseverance has been in with these 30 samples left on the ground. They'll know exactly where they are. It was going to pick them up with a claw, little robotic arm, and then it was going to bring all these samples back and put them into this solid booster, fueled rocket that came on another vehicle. And that vehicle was supposed to go up and then go into orbit and eventually dock with another spacecraft that was sent from Earth. So they've managed to cut the cost down, and here's how they did it. No longer are they going to send the fetch vehicle. That means that you don't need a separate launch from Earth to land a fetch rover on Mars to collect samples. They plan on using the Perseverance rover, since it's going to last many, many years. This flight probably won't take place until maybe 2027. So they know Perseverance will be operating at that time. And they'll use that rover that's there now, pick up its samples that's leaving all over, and they'll bring it back to the solid fueled rocket, and they'll load the cache of samples into that rocket with using Perseverance. And they always need a redundancy system. Suppose Perseverance isn't working at that time, or suppose as it's bringing it back, something goes wrong with Perseverance and it's unable to bring back all the samples. Well, they've had such luck with the helicopter Ingenuity. You might remember that they brought that up and landed it with Perseverance, and it was on the belly of Perseverance. It went down and unfolded itself, and they were hoping to get, they were going to be very happy if they could get five flights out of this thing, you know. It takes off, flies for a couple of minutes, and then it'll land in a different location. It turned out to be such a successful vehicle that they're now not up to five flights, they're up to 29 flights. This thing is still going. It's got, you know, 4 foot long blades, two long propeller blades that spin in opposite directions. And since it's so successful, the flight that goes to Mars next time with this solid fuel rocket that's going to return the samples, on that vehicle, they're going to send not one, but two helicopters. And each one is going to be bigger than the one that's there now, bigger than Ingenuity. So they'll have the helicopters, not only for more science, but they plan on using that as a backup. In case there's a problem, it'll have a little grabber on the helicopter. It'll be able to land, pick it up, and it'll fly it back to the solid fuel rocket. So after all this is done, it's cached into the solid fuel rocket. That will launch up and into orbit. And the European Space Agency has plans on putting the spacecraft into orbit around Mars, and that will eventually dock with this with the samples that launch from Mars, and then that will transfer from there from that vehicle from the rocket to the spacecraft that's now in orbit that was sent by European Space Agency. And in turn, that will eventually deorbit Mars and then come back to Earth, and they plan on having it go through the atmosphere and land in Utah, in the Utah Proving Range, they call it. So that's what they plan on doing. That might be as late as 2033. So I thought I'd mention that, and I'm sure if we're around years from now when this is all going on, we'll talk about it. But they've managed to cut the course significantly on what they had originally planned on doing. Any questions or comments? Nothing heard. Before I go any further, there was another Ares school contact. Astronaut Bob Hines with the qualifying KI-5KQT made contact with schools on, you know, planned school deal. They have one in New York, another one somewhere else. Anyway, he's very active, and you know, he's stationed on board. They go up like 6 months at a time now, and they have all these planned Ares contacts. If he doesn't do it, you know, half the astronauts that are up there are usually hams. That's still going on, and let's see that. They'll probably talk about that on Newsline tomorrow night. They usually mention the Ares contacts on Newsline. There was another manned flight last week. It was the sixth flight of the New Shepard. These things really don't even make the news anymore because they're becoming more and more common. But they put six people into the New Shepard suborbital vehicle that is built by Blue Origin, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, and successfully launched them into a suborbital flight. They got up to their 100 kilometers, which is a little over 62 miles high. And in doing that, they get about 4 minutes of weightlessness. and then they return back down. This is a all takes place in Van Horn, Texas. He's got the New Shepard there. It runs on a BE-3 liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. Gets around 130,000 pounds of thrust out of it now. And they separate the capsule from the booster. You really don't need much of a heat shield. But they're only going like 3,000, no more than 3,000 miles an hour to get up that high. A little bit less than that. So that means when they re-enter, they're not going as fast as you're normally coming back. Let's say you're in orbit, you're coming back at 17,500, where your heat shield heats up to 3,000-4,000 degrees. You don't have to worry about that with suborbital flights. Eventually, three parachutes open up on the way down, and it lands safely in the Texas desert. The booster, in turn, comes back down vertically and lands safely, very close to where it took off from. And they've done this a number of times. This flight alone is the third one this year with people in it. So if you're counting people going into space, you actually had 18 people from Blue Origin have gone into space. And here we are in August, and they're going to do more flights by the end of the year. So that number sure is getting higher and higher. Not too long ago, we used to say, 500 people have gone into space since Yuri Gagarin, and then Alan Shepard days. But before you know it, if you count all these flights and more and more flights that are going to the space station, eventually other space stations, before you know it, we're going to be doubling, 500 numbers. 500 people, before you know, it'll be 1,000 people, and so on and so forth. So, there you go. Things are moving along. Not a very fast pace, but, they're definitely moving along. Let me drop it. Any comments? WS2M. Nothing heard. Another flight that went up last week was a Korean flight. First time Korea wanted to put a spacecraft into orbit around the moon. So they hired SpaceX to launch their orbital vehicle. And it's a 1,500-pound spacecraft, all kinds of, a half a dozen different instruments on board. Different kinds of test instruments, including cameras, including one special camera, a very sensitive camera by NASA. NASA joined in with South Korea on it, and they put a special camera that could look deep inside these crater-like structures. And what they really are is that they want to look at is lava tubes. If it is what they believe it is, they pretty much know that it is. There's hundreds of these things on the moon. You could, if you're inside, physically inside, you could have roughly a normal temperature, like 68 degrees. Whether it's dark, dark or light there. You have 14 days of daylight, 14 days of night. So eventually they plan on using these locations as potential bases on the moon. And what this camera does is look, it's much more sensitive than the one that they have on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's been put into orbit by NASA back in 2009, still going. And this one is supposed to be like 100 times more sensitive. So it'll be able to really investigate these lava tubes. But anyway, to get into orbit, it's less expensive. you know, per payload. If they send this thing all the way out, roughly a million miles past the moon first, they don't need retro rockets to slow it down and put itself into orbit. It just gets out to that point and then eventually starts getting pulled back by the Earth and moon's gravity, and then it starts to return back to a quarter of a million miles away, and eventually we'll go into orbit around the moon. And they want to have it into a relatively low orbit, I think 50 or 60 miles above the Earth's surface. So that won't happen until a couple months from now. I think it could take a while to do it. But because there's no people on board, they don't have to worry about it. If you were launching people, then you would have to have retro rockets and slow yourself down. You know, you can't make it a three-month trip. You need like a three-day trip. There you go. Any comments on the Korean, the successful launch, by the way? Everything's working well on this particular flight. And South Korea has goals of eventually putting people on the moon. They signed up with the Ottomans Accord with NASA. And they're heavily involved in the space program now. And they have their own launch vehicle. We've just recently successfully put a medium class vehicle, put a couple thousand pounds into orbit, no problem now. Any comments? Okay, the Antares program, that's the one that launches out of Virginia, and it's also Grumman launches that, and they've been using the RD-181 engines, which come out, they're made from in the Ukraine. Now, with the problems with Ukraine and Russia, they need new engines. So they've been discussing this for a couple of years now on what they're going to do to replace the Antares engine. And now they have a contract now with a company called Firefly. Firefly is another company that's developing their own rocket, also a lunar landing vehicle. But Firefly is a medium lift vehicle, successfully launched last year. The second stage didn't work out, but they plan on doing it again this year. But they have these engines that they use for first stage that they plan on using for the Antares launches. So they've teamed up with Northrop Grumman, and we'll see how it goes. They're called Miranda engines. There's a contract that people wondered years ago, what's going to happen with the Antares? You won't be able to launch. And the reason Antares is important, on top of it, the space vehicle that they launch is Cygnus, and Cygnus is a cargo vehicle. It sends, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 pounds of stuff up to the International Space Station every now and then. They have enough engines for two more flights. So they don't think these engines are going to be ready in time. So they've actually made another contract with SpaceX this time to launch three of their Cygnus vehicles. That gives them plenty of time to develop the new engines for the Antares vehicle. Any comments or questions? And I'm starting to lose my voice. I'll probably shut this down a little early. We're a couple of weeks away, but I have to talk about the STS launch, Space Launch System. They're good to go. They've worked out some of the difficulties that they've had, leaks and this and that. The STS is going to launch the Orion spacecraft to the moon on the 29th of August, hopefully. Unmanned at this time, but the Orion vehicle is a spacecraft. If you put people in there, they would do just fine. Then the next flight, roughly a year and a half from now, we'll have people. And it's going to pretty much duplicate this flight. Not exactly. This is going to be a 42-day test mission. where when they put a crew in, it will be no longer than 3 weeks. Any comments or questions? If not, I'm going to turn it back to Roy. This is WS2N. Nothing heard. We'll be back next week. And thank everybody that listened to me. And we'll be here tomorrow night, hopefully on Monday night when we have the Club InfoNet. And that's always on at 8:30. And that's usually followed by Swap and Shop and then followed by Newsline, like I mentioned there earlier. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, this is WS2N. For the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. AC2GS. Well, good to have you back, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net. Thank you for all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And once again, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I had fun. I hope you did too. I hope you learned a few things. That you'll join us next Sunday at 8 o'clock when we do it all over again. Let me just remind you of the usual links. If you want to reach me via email for either mailbag questions, comment suggestions, puzzles, or to tell Paul about something, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Of course, Paul's email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. The link page, available 24/7 with interesting articles, and if I see something good on YouTube, I put it up there. That's available all the time. Just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. We have the audio stream of the TechNet, and I leave it on all day and night, so if you don't have access to a radio and an antenna, and you do have internet, and you want to listen to what's going on in the repeater, you just type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring that to you. And as always, I'd like to remind people of my KC2NJI's great archive site, amateurradio.tv, with over 1 million visitors. It has archives of the technical net going as far back as September of 2006. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, so as Dick always would end his technical net with the recommendation of be kind to each other, I think that's good advice any old day. It is particularly good advice these days. We live in dangerous times. The Chinese had a great curse. May you live in interesting times. These are very interesting and quite dangerous. So be kind to each other, be good to each other, take care of each other. Be it friend, enemy, or stranger. As I've gotten to quote Epictetus, it is impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So please, think of that term in your life. We all have these little bits and pieces of fluff that we think are knowledge that are just nothing. And if it's taking up space in your brain, best to be replaced with more accurate knowledge. So that's what we deem to do every Sunday night, and I hope you do that or try to do that every day of your life. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limar Technical Net, and with that, I am clear. Okay, I couldn't make out your call sign. You're about 90% noise. So if there's a direction you could wiggle your antenna or pick up the gain a little bit, try again.
KD2VHD, is this better? I've been swapping repeaters because there's been some trouble.
Okay, that's fine, Jim.
Good, I'm back on the Sylvan repeater. On a small technical point, on the end of your conversation earlier, you mentioned some scientific laws of, I forget what exactly it was. But isn't it true that scientific laws is actually a misnomer? Isn't there only scientific theories always adaptable to new information? Or am I missing the point of the scientific theory? I'm open to be educated, but I'm thinking I got it right. to?
There are laws in physics and there are theories in physics. Theories have to do more with the overall concept of how something is happening. Laws tend to be relatively simple equations that people use.
So they're mathematical representations of observations we make. They're not laws that are, you know, saying this must happen this way. It's just that we observe this happens this way.
Yes, and you see that in the laws of thermodynamics. Now, they're unfortunately not universal laws. So there are very, very weird cases in which conservation of energy doesn't quite work. But they are so far away from normal existence that you basically have to create a universe to demonstrate those failure points.
Understood. I don't want to make a big philosophical thing of it. I just wanted to make a point. Thank you very much. Good job tonight. I believe OGP was looking to get it.
My point in theory is like the way how things work, and like with a theory that it could happen, or things that could be done in a specific way, but kind of experimental, if you know what I mean, Roy.
Well, again, laws just kind of presuppose a relatively simple concept. The law of thermodynamics, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It can just be changed from one form to another and can be moved from one place to another. So that's a relatively simple concept. It doesn't really require any really heavy-duty mathematics. Theories, unfortunately, have problems. The concept of theory has two different definitions if you're a scientist and if you're a general person out there. You may think that on full moons, people get act crazy. And to you, you would say that that's a theory. Scientists would not call that a theory.
That's complete.
In scientific jargon, a theory is a highly tested and something that has not been misproven after a great deal of research. So even though the theory of general relativity has been tested over 100 years and has consistently never failed, it will always be called a theory because that's just the way that scientists call these things. And because, again, it's not a simple concept that physical laws tend to be. It's a more profound understanding of an innate aspect of space-time itself. So theories are never fully proven. They can only be disproven. So that's what scientists use. Whereas lay people just have an idea and they use the term theory. For them that's fine, but if you kind of stand in both fields, you confuse everyone with what you particularly mean is a theory.
Well, it's just my thought. There's really no wrong answer to it, but I do appreciate you clarifying that for me. I mean, we always have theories on how things could be done, but there's not really a right or wrong answer is if it really can be done that way or not. So that's really all that matters.
Well, once again, there are a lot of things that have been proven wrong. There are people who, quote, have a theory, end quote, that the Earth is flat. They are wrong by a multitude of different methods that you can just looking out at the horizon. You will see objects dropping from the bottom down, which is only explainable by a curved surface. And there's 10 billion other different ways. So there are a lot of ideas people have that are relatively easily proven wrong. Now there are concepts that come very close to what probably is going on in the real world, and the models that are made only break under certain circumstances, and it takes a lot of time and effort to find the boundaries where your theoretical theory breaks, and then it's no longer used. People still use Newtonian gravity. is not accurate at a certain point, where relativity kind of causes perturbation, a different solution to the problem that is much more accurate and seen in real life. So that's the difference between someone's idea and another person's well thought out and researched and tested theory.
Sure, it's nice that we all have our ideas and theories, but it's just nice, you know, to know what's truly going on out there. Speaking of, now that you mentioned people out there that believe the Earth is flat, never going to forget the moment I read the book where Columbus's men said, if we keep going, we're going to fall off the edge of the Earth, because they were tired of sailing and trying to find India, and that's when they found North America instead. I believe he docked either in Georgia or Florida, but man, never going to forget that moment when his men thought the Earth was flat.
Well, I think he landed actually in Central America, and I doubt they actually said that. It sounds like something that you would read in some kind of a, I don't know, a strange little colloquial history book. People have known that the Earth was round for thousands of years. It was kind of proven by the Greeks 2,000 years ago. So most reasonably educated people knew the Earth wasn't flat, have known it for thousands of years. The big question was how big it was, which we already did know. And what really, and actually Columbus thought it was smaller. So he thought that he could survive a trip around it to India. He didn't realize that, number one, he got it wrong, and if there was no North and South and Central America, he would have perished because he would have never reached India with the supplies he had. But he was fortunate that there was an entire number of continents in the middle of Europe and Asia that was suitable to land in. So that was where he was lucky.
Yeah, I hear you. Turn it on my notifications on my phone. I miss reading all those books and reading all those stories. Some of them may seem like the ideas for like things to happen are true, but they're of course stories. I mean, Christopher Columbus, for example, that actually was a true story. I would hope so. A lot of these books are based off of true stories, and I find them interesting to read. It's just, you know, my style. Past 11, I don't want to keep you up past your bedtime. I also hate to tell you this, but the reason why a roof antenna is a no-go, which I feel like is really a dumb reason, is because it's their house.
Well,
PhD.
Yes, Jim recognized. One second. Unfortunately or fortunately, that's an adequate answer. They pay the bills. They get to tell you what to do. I think someone mentioned, it might have been Jim, to find a new house. You know, it's easier to do when you're starting out in life and such. But those are the rules, you know. If you get yourself a family, most likely you and the missus are going to tell the kids what they can and can't do, and hopefully you'll expect them to obey your rules when living under your roof. But I get the sense that perhaps Jim will kind of say something similar, but we'll find out in a second. So, Jim?
It's funny how the streams cross on this. A law, use that word in science, and we use it in physics, not physics, civics and politics. Politics or civics or law is something that's been decided that you will or will not do. Science, my understanding is, it's something that we've observed and we're pretty sure this is the way things work. And it's subject to further discussion. And laws also are in a different way, but the word law is used very different in science versus in politics. And so as much as I was a little critical, and I agree with Roy's statement, which was repeating mine from earlier, about, yeah, it's not your house. From a technical sense, that's from a legal sense, a moral sense, a societal sense. Let me let it drop for a second.
from a technical sense, there are lots of workarounds. You can get an antenna dude. We'll help you. I'm sitting in the garage with a 40-foot antenna on a fence post. These things are doable. There's lots of workarounds. Don't get involved in a legal thing when you have a technical problem. These are different problems, and sometimes we have to pick which forum we want to solve our problem in. I don't know if I'm getting too complicated. I think I'm trying to make things simpler. I may be failing. I don't know. Over to Roy.
Okay, I mean, the English language is a very interesting thing. It's rich with borrowed words. It's rich with double, triple, and quadruple meanings. Quantum mechanics alone is confusing in that it uses terms that are not accurately similar to other things. They're vaguely similar, but if you draw too much similarity, you get quantum mechanics all wrong. And, you know, it's the nature of our language. So, yes, there are legal laws that are completely different. You can get away sometimes with breaking legal laws. And if you break the legal laws, you may pay a fine, you may be arrested, but there's no arrest or fine with violating the laws of physics. It just don't happen. So it's a different thing entirely. But, yeah, there's only so many words we use. We have to reuse them, unfortunately.
It's nice how we always violate the laws of physics. And technically, people do break the law and actually get away with it, but it's kind of difficult to do that. But breaking the laws of physics, you could do it over and over again and not really have any kind of consequences with it whatsoever. 82 OGB.
Now, the point is you can't break the laws of physics, not because someone's watching over you and going to punish you or charge you or arrest you, but simply because the universe is not designed to do that you would like to do that breaks the laws of physics. So if you try and build a perpetual motion machine, which violates the conservation of energy, you're not going to get a bill from the universe. You're just going to get a gizmo that doesn't do perpetual motion.
But, I'm going to see if I got it. The law of perpetual motion is really the observation that they can't be perpetual motion. Makes sense. I don't disagree with it. I think it sounds like a correct theorem. But it's merely an observation of what we see going on around us. Somebody didn't write it down and say, this is how it works, kid. We've observed that's how it works, as far as we can tell so far. It gets so esoteric, and I think we're going to get too late if we keep going on this. I've enjoyed the conversation very much with all of you. My brain is tenderizing at the very moment. I'm going to go clear. WRK 746. Gentlemen, good night. Good talking to you. Keep up the good work, Roy. We love it.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. I just want to once again put in my two cents. When I speak of perpetual motion, I tend to speak of people building devices that keep on going, where friction and all the kinds of loss that seem to be zero, which doesn't really exist in a real system. If you take just purely the English set of words for perpetual motion, if you take an object in outer space, not anywhere near any significant gravitational field, and you put it into motion, the only way you can stop it is by applying energy. That's another conservation of momentum. So you can have, quote, perpetual motion in outer space where you don't have things like friction and air resistance and all these other forces acting on it. It's just the momentum of the object. So just an additional little complication, a wrinkle on the subject.
Oh, well. 82 OGB.
Okay, dope. This is AC2GS. Have pleasant dreams, fellows, and I am clear.